Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Starr. I'm the interim general manager here at KPFK, and welcome to the Pacifica Experiment. Every Monday in March, we're going to be covering a variety of subjects near and dear to our hearts here at KPFK-FM in Los Angeles. Today, we're going to do a little history. And joining me today is Brian DeShazier of the Pacifica Archives, our manager of the archives. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Stephen.
And also on the phone with me is our good friend, Matthew Lazar, the wonderful, wonderful historian of Pacifica. Matthew?
Glad to be on board.
Great to have you. Before we get started, we're going to jump in on a terrific montage that'll give you a real flavor for Pacifica history that was recently produced by Peter Beauchamp in New York. Let's take it now.
The American people desire and are determined to work for peace on earth, a just and lasting peace based on genuine agreement freely arrived at by equals. In the pursuit of these aims, the United States and other like-minded nations find themselves directly opposed by a regime of contrary aims and a totally different concept of life. That regime adheres to a false philosophy. That false philosophy is communism.
President Truman.
To listener sponsored radio, KPFA in Berkeley.
This is KPFK in Los Angeles.
And you're listening to WBAI in New York. In Houston, this is listener sponsored KPFT.
WPFW in Washington.
What was amazing at the height of the McCarthy era was the notion of such a station existing anywhere.
Time passed. Many romantic feelings were associated with radio broadcasting.
Pacifica found
as with aviation. With motoring across the far western United States. Such memories have a certain literary appeal, no doubt, but they are also authentic.
Today we plan to look at Pacifica 50 years, to look at some of the high points and low points from Pacifica being on the air in 1949 from Berkeley under the leadership of Lou Hill, one of the most intriguing characters about which you could read in any area of work.
Listener sponsorship, of course, is an effort to complete the integration of this medium with the community of which it is part.
Pacifica Radio was the brainchild of Lewis Hill, a pacifist and poet.
Verna Avery
Hill
Brown.
And four others incorporated the Pacifica Foundation in 1946 and put KPFA on the air in 1949. KPFA represented a radical model for a nonprofit, community-based radio station operating outside the parameters of mainstream broadcasting. Hill concluded that only a non-commercial broadcasting system financed by listener sponsorship could be free of commercial and governmental strictures.
The listener sponsorship experiment pioneered here has become the model for a good many like efforts around the country, in television as well as radio.
Lewis Hill was a man who believed very much in the importance and necessity of struggle at the spiritual level. So much so that we have often had arguments about it. However, he was at the same time a pacifist and a poet and a great humanist.
The fundamental philosophy of Pacifica was to establish an institution which would, in essence, bring people together who seemed to have a basic worldview, at least as best as I can tell from reading some of the old documents.
People who started the Pacifica Foundation were, for the most part, pacifists who had grown up in the pacifist student movement of the 1930s. Lewis Hill, Roy Finch, various people who were associated with the early Pacifica movement. Many of them were associated with the War Resisters League, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, other groups like that.
Then, too, there was really the importance of volunteers, which, you know, I mean, Hill really, himself, he was a ham radio operator. And he went back, and so there's a link between him and just the earliest, the freest period, really, in radio history when people had a sense of ownership and before the networks kind of squeezed out all the community and independent nonprofit stations.
In which it is no longer a parasitical entertainment device manipulated by abstract personalities in the remote ether, but is instead a real place only a few steps up from the street. an instrument for real thought and serious intercourse, an integrating and synthesizing aspect of the community.
To me, the tragedy of the United States in this century is not the crack-up of an empire we never knew what to do with in the first place, but a collapse of the idea of the citizen as someone autonomous, whose private life is not subject to orders from above. Today, hundreds of thousands of Americans are only marginally free as they undergo mandatory blood tests, urine tests, lie detector tests. Speech is theoretically free, but the true pulpit, electronic or print, is pretty much denied anyone who does not support the patriarchal state and all its misdeeds at home and abroad.
What was amazing at the height of the McCarthy era was the notion of such a station existing anywhere.
And that would be the voice of Lou Hill, our illustrious founder of the Pacifica Network. And before that, Gore Vidal and a host of others. This is a remarkable montage created by Peter Beauchamp. We're on the phone with Matthew Lazar and in the studio with Brian...
DeShazer.
Brian DeShazer from our archives, the man who knows where every single voice can be found. I want to start with you, Matthew. We're here talking about history, and there is a great obsession on our parts. Why do you think that Pacifica Radio is so into its own history?
Well, it's really true. It's a really good question. You know, I sometimes ask people just for fun, do you know when the first written history of Pacifica Radio came out? And people will say, you know, people will guess, they'll guess, you know, the 1970s or the 1980s or something like that.
I actually don't know.
Yeah. Well, actually, it came out 5 months after KPFA went on the air. It was called KPFA After 5 Months on the Air. It was a complete history of everything that had been done so far. And the same thing can be said to some extent with KPFK. You know, KPFK, early KPFK, had a wonderful programmer named Carlos Hagen. Brian, are you familiar with him?
Oh, yes. His name pops up quite often.
In fact, you can get his wonderful programs in the archives.
Right.
Carlos Hagen was a very early KPFK programmer, and a couple of years after KPFK went on the air, he started doing historical retrospectives of KPFK. One just a couple of years afterwards called KPFK Over the Years, as if the organization was, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 years old like it is now. And, of course, every 5 years, there's a anniversary celebration, and, you know, folios or whatever is available, whatever is being used now has a big retrospective, and there's a birthday celebration, and there's a birthday documentary. And it's all, and it's this constant reifying of itself through history. And it is a very interesting question why it is that it is like that. And I think that one of the reasons for that is because the uniqueness of Pacifica, and it's really its radical otherness from mainstream American life makes it very difficult for the organization to find external reference points. What do companies do in order to measure measure themselves and evaluate themselves? Well, they compare themselves to other companies. What do universities do? Well, they compare themselves to other universities. What can Pacifica compare itself to, really? Nothing. So instead of measuring itself laterally or spatially, what it does is it measures itself temporally. It's constantly evaluating and reevaluating and rethinking about itself by its own past. Pacificans are constantly historicizing the organization so as to have some kind of reference point. And I think that that's one of the reasons why anniversaries are so important to Pacifica. It's sort of these moments when the organization, it's each of its different radio stations, reconsiders and thinks about itself anew. And I think that that's the reason why the organization is so into and even so obsessed with its own history.
Right, Matthew. I was also thinking while you were talking, you know, indeed, after 5 months, they had a history. And also the organizations and the movements that were there that Pacifica supported and therefore the organization supported, those grassroots movements like the free speech movement and the Black Panther Party and even the communists at the time, they didn't really have an outlet to create their own history on that small level. I can't imagine the Black Panther Party having an archivist in the time when they were having the Black Panther rallies up in Berkeley in the 60s. So Pacifica, looking at itself, I would argue that it sort of helps support those organizations and their histories.
Well, I don't know whether the Black Panther Party had an archivist or not. They may very well have had an archivist or somebody who was saving everything. It's very possible. I think that it is also true that many of these organizations do have very careful histories of themselves. But I still think that one of the reasons why Pacifica is so constantly reorganizing and reifying its own history is because it has no external reference points. It is also true, however, I do agree with you, that if it wasn't for Pacifica Radio, the American left wouldn't have been on the radio over the last 50 years. I mean, yes, it's true that occasionally some people would have been on some radio station at some point. But the only organization over the last half century that has really given the American left any kind of full and fair hearing has been the Pacifica Radio Network. Without it, I think that the history of the American left would have been extremely different.
Right. You know, I had a chance. Brian took me up into the archives when I first came over here, and we walked the halls of the archives, and, you know, this incredible volume and body of tape and archive material. It occurred to me that it's a historian's dream.
It was my dream.
Yeah.
When I was doing my doctoral dissertation on the Pacifica Radio Network, I spent weeks and weeks in the archives. They treated me very kindly and generously. Mm-hmm. I just sat there listening to tapes and transcribing tapes. It was just a glorious experience. I miss it.
The other thought that came to me as I was moving through those halls and those shelves was, it would probably be a interesting way to analyze and do problem solving throughout the history of the left. I wonder if you agree with that. Is exploring the archives a way to do that?
Well, you know, the archives is just as incredibly, it must be one of the world's great audio libraries. Surely it is one of those things, because it just has thousands and thousands of documents of the entire world's English-speaking left. Mm-hmm. I mean, Brian, you tell me all the different people who are in the archives at this point.
Oh, I think the very first catalog description is a 10-part series of Aldous Huxley speeches from the 1950s. And although we know that Pacifica started in 1949, you may know that the first 10 years, the organization was so poor they couldn't keep tape stock running, so they recycled it. So the first 10 years is virtually gone. In 1959, each of the stations started collecting their materials, and then in 1971, centralized it into what is now the Pacifica Archives. But what's in there represents, on a national basis, like you said, the American left and the progressive, and anybody that didn't have a voice on the other networks. So it's not necessarily identified as the progressive left. Madeline Murray O'Hare, the noted atheist, or disappeared atheist, she's in there. We have more material on Anais Nin than anyone that I can think of, other than probably the UCLA archive where her diaries are. Again, the Black Panther Party movement, the Free Speech Movement Party, or not the party, but the Free Speech Movement. The Kartop rallies and the student movement in Berkeley and the Sproul Hall sit-ins are really amazing to me because they were there as it began. You know, nobody had to call the news station and wait for them an hour to get there to cover the piece. But they were there when the Kartop rally started. So you can hear Mario Savio get on a car, get a megaphone, and start yelling to the crowd and inspiring them and invigorating them. And that's just a small little piece of what I
actually one of the people who was at those rallies is a friend of mine in England named John Whiting, who once told me that he still has one of the tape recorders that was used.
Oh,
and,
wow!
He got an egg thrown at him at one point during one of those rallies, and a little piece of that egg is still on that tape recorder, and he keeps it as a sort of a precious souvenir.
Wow.
Amazing. So we're going to take this opportunity throughout the month of March to explore a variety of issues that keep popping up in Pacifica's history. We're going to explore the issues around public affairs versus cultural programming. We're going to explore the issues around hate speech and free speech, how those two intersect and or converge and create tensions and dissonances. We're going to explore issues around the Band and the Fire, those over the years, and there's a long history of people leaving Pacifica under difficult circumstances and coming back. These are all this is all food for thought. We have a remarkable history of problems and problem solvings, wouldn't you say, Matthew?
Absolutely. I think that it's been a very, very difficult 7 years for the organization, and I'm hoping that cooler heads will prevail and that we can work out some of these problems.
Right. I think Pacifica, certainly looking at the history and some of those early dialogues about what Pacifica was about, are in the archives, and it strikes me that it's an organization that's ever-evolving. I know we have a cut coming up from the HUAC committee, and I believe this is William Mandel's testimony. It's a very famous Pacifica piece that you listeners might have heard already. But to set it up, you know, William Mandel, it doesn't say it in the piece, William Mandel was a Pacifica programmer for many years and was a Sovietologist, and he did have a program about communism and about the Soviet Union. And when he was called to HUAC, this is what his response was.
Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Communist Party?
If you think that I am going to cooperate with this collection of Judases, of men who sit there in violation of the United States Constitution, if you think I will cooperate with you in any way, you are insane.
In 1946, 1947, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce set up through a special committee on communism, blueprinted the post-war witch hunt. It blueprinted the blacklisting of the entertainers. It blueprinted the purge of government officials and of labor unions. One has to recognize that one of the evils about the use of the FBI as a political police lies in the fact that there's been a mushroom growth since the war of extra-legal and extra-constitutional methods for purging and destroying people in ways that do not require a surveillance of the criminal courts.
Because of my political views, which I certainly did not expect in a democracy, that I've been prevented from exercising my craft. On the other hand, I have never separated my work as an artist from my work as a human being.
Paul Robeson.
I've always put it even more strongly that, to me, my art is always a weapon. It's got to be good art.
A poet can be an orator. He can use a soapbox style to make himself heard over the static. But try to mount the box without the soap.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
The poet must be the real barbarian, descending on society, moving continually downward, not upward, in it, and saying what he hears with his ear to the ground.
If you have the strength here, which you have, to stand with the administration and say, we want free speech on campus, you can have through the rest of your life the strength to stand up whenever you see something you don't like, don't believe in segregation, or to say to the government, I don't believe in war. And you really have to do it.
My fellow citizens, this government, as promised,
John F. Kennedy,
has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba.
The revolutionary people are not normal people. That I can assure you. The revolutionary makes the revolution. But the revolution makes the revolutionary.
Commandante Guevara was dressed in pressed military fatigues and polished black boots. During the conversation, he was in constant motion, lying on his side, shifting to a squatting position, back to his side, resting his head on his hands, and puffing constantly on a cigar. Constant motion.
Where the revolutionary achieves a higher level of conscience.
You don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn the other cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a nonviolent revolution.
What is it that made them decide that today was a beautiful day on which to die? What force within them generated that?
The time had just come when I had been pushed as far as I could stand to be pushed, I suppose.
Rosa Parks.
I had decided that I would have to know once and for all what rights I had as a human being. and a citizen, even in Montgomery, Alabama.
Rosa Parks.
Wow.
And before her, Malcolm X. And before Malcolm X, Che Guevara and Joan Baez and Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Paul Robeson.
And Paul Robeson. And starting with a House Un-American Activities Committee meeting with Mr. Mandel declaring that they are crazy.
Insane.
This is all...
What's interesting about that Bill Mandel tape, if you can get at the archive, you can get the whole hearing.
Right.
And while everyone else during the McCarthy era, or lots of people during the McCarthy era, were busily ducking for cover, hiring lawyers, desperately trying to get out of the glare of McCarthyism, William Mandel was one of the few people to be subpoenaed and interrogated by all three major federal anti-communist committees, McCarthy's, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, and the House Un-American Activities Committee, otherwise known as UAC. And he actively sought out these opportunities to publicly challenge them. If you listen to the whole tape, just before he's on, you can hear him on the microphone gesticulating to the television cameras and saying to them, hey, turn on the lights. You want a good show?
Mm-hmm.
You want to see something? You want to see something happening? Turn on the lights right now, because I'm going to give this committee a really good show.
Right, and in the archives, it's juxtaposed with the testimony by Paul Robeson and Bertolt Brecht's testimony before HUAC, and also the very first HUAC committee meeting is also recorded in the archive. And those four pieces together really give you a taste of what it was like to be called before them, and also what the people of Pacifica and the type of people that Pacifica are made up of, how they respond to such a thing.
And Pacifica was called before those committees, too.
Right.
Let's contextualize those voices inside the history we're trying to cover here. Let me ask you, Matthew, what role did the idea of free speech play in Lewis Hill's vision for Pacifica?
Well, in order to understand Lewis Hill's vision of Pacifica Radio, you have to understand a number of things. One of the most important things is that, and this is an argument I have with a lot of scholarship about Pacifica, we tend to see Lewis Hill as very static.
Mm-hmm.
As somebody who always thought one thing throughout his regrettably brief life. He killed himself when he was 38 years old. But in fact, Lewis Hill changed his mind and became a different person in the later part of his life than he was in the earlier part of his life. He was, like everybody else, somebody who grew and changed. And so it's important to remember that when you're thinking about Lewis Hill. Lewis Hill's vision for KPFA when it first went on the air was very much informed by the fact that he and his conscientious objector friends had been completely marginalized by the Second World War experience. They had been shunted off to remote conscientious objectors camps where they had basically been completely censored and were not able to give their message to the public. The overwhelming popular sentiment was that the U.S. being involved in the Second World War was a good thing. I mean, that's certainly what I would have thought if I had been alive during that period, and my father fought in the Second World War. And Hill and his friends, sitting in one of these remote CO camps, looked at each other and they said, where did we go wrong? Because in the 1930s, pacifism had been very popular. And what they concluded was that they needed to use technology to present the pacifist message in a more credible way. And the other thing that they felt very strongly was that they had to present pacifism as part of a wide variety of ideologies, so that it would be seen as more credible than just presenting it and just shouting it out and ranting it out in what Lewis Hill sometimes called newsletter pacifism. He wanted pacifists to control the debate over a radio station, but also bring in a lot of other people with other perspectives as well in this kind of ongoing dialogue, which would center around pacifist questions. So the original vision, in a sense, was really a vision of dialogue. But it was also true that very quickly they discovered at KPFA and then at KPFK and WBAI that there were certain historical moments when people were afraid to talk. Most people were afraid to talk. Lewis Hill, if you go to my website, which is www.lasarletter.com, that's LASARLETTER.com, you can find old talks that Lewis Hill gave over the radio. And one of them, he gives a commentary in which he says, we wanted to do a program about the militarization of the universities. And we talked to 20 professors, and we asked them to be on, this was in 1950, about the militarization of the universities, and not one of them was willing to go on the air and talk about this issue. And so I'm just on the air now to tell you that I'm very concerned about this issue, that I think that the militarization of the University of California is a very bad thing. And in this context came the second and equally important Pacifica tradition, the tradition of dissent. The tradition that if no one else will say this, well, we will. We're the ones who'll speak out against the Vietnam War. We're the ones who'll speak out against McCarthyism. Lewis Hill in 1949, a couple of weeks after the station went on the air, he got on the air and he said, the FBI is a contemptible institution and the whole country knows it. If someone comes to your door, an FBI agent comes to your door demanding information, refuse to cooperate. Say, I, for my part, will not. This was the beginning of the second and equally important tradition, the tradition of dissent. So, in a sense, early Pacifica inaugurated these two different visions of free speech, dialogue and dissent. And, unfortunately, these two traditions have been at war with each other within the organization, rather than peacefully coexisting and, in fact, depending on one another, which is what should happen. These ideas should not be at war with each other. Factions may be at war with each other, but these two things complement each other, and they make the organization stronger. So these are really sort of the two polarities of the Pacifica mission.
In the middle there somewhere, Matthew, is the idea of language that should and should not be broadcast on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
I think that one of the historical references I know as somebody who came into this organization recently but have a long sense of history are the seven dirty words and Pacifica's insistence on taking it to the Supreme Court. Could you just review that for folks who may not be familiar?
Well, in 1973, a wonderful programmer in WBAI New York City named Paul Gorman decided to do some kind of a program. I'm not sure exactly what the focus of it was. It was on at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I think it was on a Tuesday in October of 1973, on language. And for this, he decided to play a very funny record, at least I think it's a very funny record, of the comedian George Carlin, who did a routine called The Seven Dirty Words You Can't Say on Television, which, unfortunately, I can't say on this radio show either, and I really ought not to say them. The program was listened to by a man and his son driving in their car, and he filed a complaint with the Federal Communications Commission. And the Federal Communications Commission contacted WBAI and Pacifica, and they said, we agree with this complaint, and we're putting it in your file. And essentially what they were saying was, well, that's one. You know, this is your first warning, and we're putting this in your file, and the next time your license comes up, we're gonna take this out, we're going to ask you about it. Now, the Pacifica National Board decided that they would take this matter to court. And note well here, here's an example. I mean, those were the days. And here's an example where the Pacifica National Board backed a programmer up. I'm looking forward to further days like that in the future. And they took the matter to court, and they won in the federal district courts. But the FCC appealed it to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Supreme Court of the United States said that it was appropriate for this thing to have been put in Pacifica's file. That the right to privacy, I think Justice Powell said, the right to privacy, the right of people not to be assaulted, I think that was the word that was used by this, was more important than the First Amendment. Pacifica had argued, well, you know, if you don't like it, turn off the radio. But Powell argued that you couldn't do that necessarily because you have the radio on and suddenly you get hit with this thing. It was true, however, that Gorman had said something in advance saying that if you didn't like this program or if you were worried about strong language, you should turn the program off. In any event, Pacifica lost that issue. Fortunately, the Federal Communications Commission in the subsequent years didn't really push their victory very hard. But this was an example of the Pacifica Foundation really going to the mat for free speech all the way as far as it possibly could.
Right, and the other one was Allen Ginsberg reading his poem Howl on the air. Did the court case sort of follow the same line as the other one?
Well, that was a court case. That was not a court case with Pacifica.
Yeah.
That was a court case in which Lawrence Ferlinghetti was selling Howl at his City Lights bookstore in San Francisco, which is still there, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti is still there, I'm happy to say. And the police busted him. And this matter was between City Lights books and the San Francisco Police Department, or actually I think it was the federal, the feds actually came in and got involved in this. What Pacifica did, what KPFA did, was that they actually played the show. They played Allen Ginsberg reading Howell, and they had a discussion about it. And what's interesting about that panel discussion is that Lewis Hill moderated that panel discussion.
Right.
And he said, we invited the San Francisco Police Department, the San Francisco District Attorney, federal agents, and various people to this panel, which included Lawrence Ferlinghetti and a critic named, a number of critics and a librarian. But none of them would come. And so we're very sorry that they wouldn't come, and we don't want to belabor this point and congratulate ourselves over agreeing on this issue. For Lewis Hill, the point of freedom of speech was to promote dialogue, and the point of dialogue was to promote what he called lasting understanding towards what he called a Pacific world in our time. People would understand each other better. They would be able to reconcile their differences sometimes, and there would be a more peaceable world. That was the Pacifica vision.
So I'm going to jump around here a bit, Matthew, and then in about 10 minutes we're going to take some calls. One of the subjects we're going to be discussing on Mondays in March coming up on this Pacific Experiment series has to do with the idea of journalism versus activism. There is a long history of a tension between those two ideas on the Pacifica Network, and I wonder if you can tell us where it all started and what the ideas behind it are.
Well, there's a very good book about Pacifica Radio, which I urge people who are interested in this problem to read, and that's Jeff Land's Active Radio, Pacifica's Brash Experiment, which has a section in it about WBAI in the 1960s and the 1970s that's very well written and very useful. WBAI sort of went through a period after the United States got out of Vietnam in which there was a fight between two groups of people. One was the Left Radio Group, I think it was called, and the other called itself the Good Radio Group. And the Good Radio Group was very into what they described as professional radio and quality and the art of radio. And the Left Radio Group really saw itself as the more multicultural group, activist group, that was supporting revolutionary movements. And both sides fought with each other back and forth over this for a long period of time, and eventually, like all Pacifica fights, it sort of drifted away, the next Pacifica fight. The people who started Pacifica Radio, Lewis Hill and his associates, boasted in some of their fundraising literature that they were professional journalists. And this wasn't really true. Lewis Hill had been a part-time radio announcer. There is absolutely no evidence that he ever did anything except rip and read radio broadcasting. I could find no evidence that he actually wrote a story of any kind on his own. His friend Eleanor McKinney had a one-hour-a-week radio show with an NBC affiliate. Nobody else had any on-air experience with radio when KPFA went on the air, and some of the people there were very charming, but if you listen to Kenneth Rexroth, for example, the poet Kenneth Rexroth's early show on KPFA, he obviously had no experience at all. He said, almost as much as I do on the air. So the professionalism that they talked about wasn't really there. Like most of these binary oppositions, these fights that take place on Pacifica Radio, the fight is usually 85% bogus. You want a balance between the two. The virtue of activist radio is that it urges people to act, to be players in their communities. It brings to the forefront on the air issues and causes that would never get on the radio otherwise. And it's very important to have activist radio. That is to say, radio broadcasters who really come from the movements that they're talking about and who identify with those movements. The problem with activist radio, at least I think the problem with activist radio, is that sometimes it tends to skimp on production value. And in addition, activist radio-oriented journalists often won't take up tough internal questions about their movements over the airwaves. They will just sort of sidestep those issues because they're more interested in the political cause in the moment than they are in stepping back and looking at something from a broader perspective. The virtue of more professional radio is that it often just sounds better. Its adherents tend to be Renaissance people who can bring a broader perspective to any issue. And also, they tend to step back and to ask critical questions that need to be asked about left movements. The problem with journalism-oriented producers is that they sometimes become distant from the lives of the people on the ground floor of American life. My experience is that their favorite guests are politicians, policy wonks, book authors, and best of all, other journalists. They tend to really like to interview other journalists. And the question of what is to be done sometimes gets replaced by what is to be said. And the broadcasting tends to be less oriented towards the concerned actor instead of the concerned spectator. Instead, it tends to broadcast for what I call the concerned spectator.
Mm.
And the answer to this problem is, I mean, for me, the answer to the problem is, what do you do about this kind of dichotomy? Is that you want to have both people central to your on-air schedule, and you want to respect both ways of doing Pacifica Radio.
So you would argue that achieving a balance between those two approaches is
a fair balance between those two, yeah.
Agreed completely. I think what we're going to do is we're going to go to a brief announcement, and then we're going to come back, and shortly after that, we're going to start taking some phone calls. So on we go.
Hi, I'm Leslie Kagan, chair of the Interim Board of Directors of the Pacifica Foundation. For the first time in 4 years, we will be meeting here in Los Angeles, and I invite you to attend this important gathering. Our weekend-long meeting will run from 6:30 to 9 p.m. on Friday, March 8th, from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Saturday, March 9th, and on Sunday, March 10th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., and you are welcome to attend any part of this meeting. The meeting of the Pacifica Foundation's board are open to the public, and we encourage you, our listeners, our supporters, to observe us at work. Just as important, there will be time throughout the weekend for community comment, time for us to hear your concerns and your ideas. Our meeting will take place at the Virgil Middle School Auditorium, located at 152 North Vermont Avenue on the northeast corner of Vermont and First Avenue. The Los Angeles Unified School District, which has granted us permission to use the school, asked us to let you know that the Board of Education does not sponsor or take responsibility, nor does it necessarily endorse any of the activities, statements, or opinions which may be expressed at the meeting. But for more information about our meeting, contact this station, KPFK, at 818-985-2711. That's 818-985-2711. Again, on behalf of the Pacifica National Board, we hope to see you at our meeting.
And that was the voice of Leslie Kagan. Leslie Kagan is the Interim Pacifica National Board Chair, and Leslie will be joining me in the studio on this coming Thursday at 4 p.m. for 1 hour to discuss the various details and matters affecting the upcoming board meeting, which, as she mentioned, takes place this Friday through Sunday, March 8th through 10th, at the Virgil Middle School in Los Angeles. Okay, so we're here again with Brian DeShazer of our wonderful historic archives upstairs, and, of course, Matthew Lazar, who has written the definitive, in my opinion, and I speak very personally on this, the definitive history on Pacifica Radio, the rise of an alternative network. Let me touch on governance for a moment, and Matthew, maybe you could jump in here. Why did Lou Hill leave listener subscribers? You know, before I mention this, I want to let the listeners know we're going to take some calls at 818-985-5735. Again, that's 818-985-5735. And I'm sure glad not to be giving that to you as a pledge number. It's great to give it to you as a phone line, although we did wonderful things.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was very successful. For those listeners who are curious, we exceeded a fund drive raise of over $700,000 locally and $180,000 for our network-wide transmitter one-day fund drive for a total of about $880,000 and still counting.
And thank you, Matthew. I know you were on the air quite a long time for a couple days there, so we really appreciate your support and your helping us out with using your book as one of the premium gifts.
Well, obviously, it's good to know that people are reading it, but I think that the real premium is the organization, and I'm glad that we've raised enough money for your transmitter.
So, again, we're going to be taking some phone calls at 818-985-5735. This will be an open phone line. And before we do that, I'd like perhaps, Matthew, you could just explain a question that struck me when I read your book. Why did Lewis Hill leave listener subscribers out of Pacifica governance?
Well, Lewis Hill was a pacifist, and he was a pacifist during an extremely popular war. And when he came to the San Francisco Bay Area in 1946, and he started KPFA, he started to work towards creating KPFA in 1949, there were some things he knew, and there were some things he didn't know. He knew who his staff would be. They would be other conscientious objectors and pacifists who had been through with him through this 1940s-era experience. He knew who his first local advisory board would be. And that would be people who were sort of luminaries in the Bay Area, and also a lot of the wealthy Quakers who had helped him financially start the organization. The one group of people who he didn't know as he was developing Pacifica Radio was who were the listeners going to be? Who were the listener subscribers going to be? He didn't know who they were. He was concerned about one thing, which is that he knew very well that, you know, it's interesting, over the years we always talk about Lewis Hill, and we talk about the fact that Lewis Hill was a pacifist and a conscientious objector, and he wouldn't fight in the Second World War. And we never step back, most of us, from that statement, which we say with this sort of warm tone. And we never step back and say, huh? Didn't fight in the Second World War? Isn't that rather odd? The truth is that his position was an incredible minority position during the Second World War. And he was very aware of the fact that he knew about us non-pacifists. I'm not a pacifist. He knew about me. He knew that everybody loves pacifists until there's a war. And then they become very suspicious of pacifists, as people are being suspicious of pacifists right now. There was an article in the Washington Post during the beginning of the bombing of Afghanistan that called pacifists fascists. Lewis Hill was very aware of the fact that there was this tremendous suspicion towards pacifism. And he was also aware of the fact, imagine if KPFA had gone on the air in 1939 rather than 1949, and it had been broadcasting throughout the San Francisco Bay Area in 1941, in 1942, and 1943, as the United States was having a pretty tough time, for example, in the Pacific theater of the war. And Lewis Hill and his friends were on the air opposing the war. What do you think would have happened if the listeners had had the vote? They probably would have voted him out of the organization. In fact, the chances are that even before that, they would have run into KPFA and dragged them all out and beat them up on the streets of Berkeley. That's probably what would have happened. So they were, because of the specific nature of their ideology, they were suspicious of popular democracy. Within the context of Pacifica Radio, they gave the staff tremendous democracy. They had a system in which everybody got to vote. All staff members got to vote on Pacifica policy. It was very, very democratic. Some people even thought too democratic. Lewis Hill started to think it was too democratic by 1953 and 1954. But as the organization grew, as it went from one radio station to three radio stations, then to four, and then by 1977 to five radio stations, and as the organization became increasingly devoted to not saying very much about its governance over the airwaves, the non-participation of the listener subscribers, I think, and the secludedness, the relative secludedness of the process of governance created an enormous gap between people on the grassroots at Pacifica Radio and the leadership, which I think is one of the reasons why we've had this terrible fight over the last few years, and one of the reasons why I think it's time to deal the listener subscribers in to some portion of governance formally. You know, we constantly say to the listener subscribers, myself among them, KPFK, KPFA, WBAI, WPFW, KPFT, it's your radio station. It's your radio station. But what does that really mean? Really, without any kind of formal say in the governance of the organization, it's not their radio station.
Right.
And so I think that Lewis Hill's way of developing Pacifica, while I understand it in historic sense, is becoming increasingly anachronistic and needs to be rethought.
Right. Okay. We're going to take some calls. The lines are open, and there are questions. I would like to go to Deanie on line 10. That would be Deanie on line 10. Deanie, what's your question? Okay, we're going to move on. We lost Deanie. Let's go to line 5. Matt, what is your question on line 5? That would be Matt.
Hello.
Hi, Matt.
Hey, I came out of a radio background in college, and a couple of years ago I went down to KPFK and volunteered, and I was really interested in your guest was commenting on you know, the activists versus the radio people in the KPFK history. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate on which direction you think it's going to go, or is there a concerted effort being made in one way or another on the station? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, well, it's nice that you should bring that up. It's pretty straightforward, Matt. We are going to be having in the next week or two a show that's devoted to that very subject, the distinctions between journalism versus activism, here on Mondays in March. It's a struggle, and it's an ongoing tension. There are those who feel that community radio should exist on the realm of activism, and people should use the station as a platform for delivering activism-related information. And then, of course, there is the entire opportunity for journalists to speak to journalistic pursuits that are not covered on other networks. I don't think there's any definitive direction that we're taking. I think there's a balance that we're trying to achieve. As Matthew so eloquently said, it's our job to try to create a balance between those two ideas. We have another call, line 8. We have Mary. We have Mary on line 8. Mary?
Hi, dear.
Hi.
I live way far away, about 100 miles, but it's so good to hear you. And I want to be active. I want to be part of it, and I understand we're going to be able to vote for lab members and things, but at some point during the fund drive, someone had mentioned the KPFK neighborhoods and being able to sort of get listeners. And as the I'm sort of right at the border here of where that you lose the signal. So I'm
Where are you?
I'm in Beaumont, which is sort of 25 miles west of Palm Springs.
I see.
And I really think there's a lot of opportunity here to get some people involved in organization and the Green Party and a number of things here, but it's through listening to Pacifica that can get people the background they need to get, you know, activated. So what I would like to do is start a KPFK neighborhood, and is that program going to go for us? And I'm just really excited about the new direction. Already, you guys sound so much better than you did, you know, 3 weeks ago.
It's a delight to hear you say that, Mary. Yes, you can absolutely start a KPFK neighborhood network. If you go to the free KPFK website,
okay,
I believe that would be a good place to start.
All right.
And take a look. But I've been to neighborhood meetings from as far south as Long Beach to way north in the valley, et cetera. And the more neighborhood groups form, the better it is for the community, for its interaction and its opportunity to let us know exactly what's needed here and how we can better serve the community.
Well, believe me, you are the only resource. We don't even have a bookstore here, so you know, we're 20 miles from anything. So to have you coming over the airwaves is just wonderful. And I really appreciate this program with the background. I think this is marvelous.
Mary, I should also mention that now that our transmitter is funded by listeners like you, you'll be able to get the signal a lot more strongly than you did.
I'm looking forward to it because banning is ripe for organizing and getting people involved and getting. So if you start something like a KPFK neighborhood, then I think we can really get people. And just doing a little, like a little sign and putting it in the window, you know, 90.7, you know, free speech radio, and getting people intrigued in that way. I just think that it's just such a marvelous resource, and I thank God we have it back. I just am so appreciative. I can't tell you.
Thank you, Mary. We're going to try to move through some more calls. We have open lines here today. The number is 818-985-5735. On line 9, we have Arturo. Arturo?
Hello?
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, following that comment from this lady, this listener, I think if you open up the avenues for community participation, and you will see that there is a mass consciousness out there that is willing to participate and improve on community radio. And what we have to do at Pacifica basically is open up the lines for people to participate, and all these wonderful ideas will come running through as to how to improve the finances, the programming, et cetera, et cetera. All we need is to open up the lines.
I agree, Arturo, and part of the process is for us to get calls like this and to develop out various ways to engage you, the listener.
Well, thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Line 11, Edgar, what is your question? That would be line 11, Edgar. I guess we've lost Edgar. Line 10, we have a Lauren. Edgar, maybe we still have you. Edgar, are you there?
Hello?
Yes?
Yeah. Well, I just want to ask, I hear a lot of these activists out there, and KPFK, I think it's a powerful media to sort of like awaken people. And what I wanted to sort of like know if all of these activists, if they're doing any some form of boycotting against media, because a lot of people are complaining about the media, but they're buying the product that's sponsoring this media. So what I'm trying to say is, like, is there any activists out there that sort of like give the lowdown on a lot of these sponsors are not buying their product, because the report that this media is giving to the public is inaccurate, and so meaning that the editors are pleasing their advertisers, not their readers or their viewers or their listeners. So I think KPFK should embark on something where they should really like start naming corporations or businesses or politicians who sort of like responsible for a lot of this, hocus pocus that's going on this planet.
Edgar, I think that it's safe to say that the KPFK regularly, daily, weekly, focuses on those kinds of concerns, I think, because we're not corporate sponsored, because we have no obligation.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, I think KPFK should also sort of, like, advocate to listeners, to the listeners of the radio station, to simplify their lives, and if they really are concerned about the environment. I mean, these people that are active, especially in Washington, last couple of years, they're fighting against these corporations, but they're using the products of these corporations that they're fighting with. They use the fax, they use the cell phones, they use the vehicles.
One group that I think is a very good group to keep up with and to be part of is Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which is a group that very actively encourages people to call radio stations, call newspapers, call television stations when they're obviously very, very biased. I believe that their website is www.fair.org, and they have regular updates. They're very smart about bias in the media from a progressive point of view, Fair is. And I would urge you to go to their website and check out their regular updates.
Well,
which are very,
what I'm
very
saying
good.
Is, like, I think that's Media and Accuracy program. I mean, programs that's featured on KPFK, there's a lot of political programs, but a lot of these programs is sort of like interviewing journalists and politicians and a lot of these people, but they're not really like I think Pacifica should really embark on something where they educate people to simplify their lives.
It's a great idea, Edgar, and I take it to heart. We will definitely try to give people more information on how they can live a lifestyle that's not driven by corporate interests, and we're going to take another call. And,
Thank you.
You're very welcome. I want to interrupt you just to say that when Mary called earlier, I gave her the free KPFK website. It is not correct. The Neighborhood Network, the Free Pacifica Neighborhood Network, can be found at FPNN. That's www.fpnn.org. And that's a great place for any of you out there to find your local Free Pacifica Neighborhood Network meetings, and or if you'd like to start your own, there's click-through there to show you how to get started and to make inquiry. Let's take another call. We're going to move on to line 7. We have Matt on line 7. Matt, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if it's possible to put a new show on either daily or at least weekly, which is only taking calls from the listeners.
Mm. Well, since I've gotten here, we've started to open the phone lines, and today is actually the first day that we've opened the lines up without screening. Actually, a few calls were screened incidentally at the top of the show, but we're taking completely open calls right now. I think it's a great idea. Matt, we're going to do more of this, and especially on this particular series.
Yeah, I think it needs to be institutionalized even after this series is over, because the listeners are the safety net. You know, if the listeners have input, then this kind of thing will not go down again.
I absolutely agree with you there. And it's worth mentioning historically, as I'm sure Matthew could speak to, I think Lou Hill initiated the first call-in show, didn't he?
I'm not sure if that's true, actually. Huh. I'm afraid that I would like to be able to say that Lewis Hill initiated the first listener call-in show, but I think that it may have happened somewhere else. I'm not up on that. Sorry.
It's okay. I just made an assumption. I'm glad I have a real historian on the line to straighten me out. Thank you for that, Matthew. Okay, we'll take another call. Line 11, Slasher, line 11.
Well, hello. This is Slasher calling from Houston, Texas.
Oh, fantastic.
I'm calling, and I want to compliment you on your show here. Now, with respect to governance, I want to make a comment. First of all, the recent settlement requires that the stations essentially elect have listener sponsors elect local advisory boards for the station there. Now, under the Corporation for Public Broadcasting community advisory board requirements, which at this point you are taking Corporation for Public Broadcasting money. It says specifically under composition of community advisory boards and interpretations, it says no individual representative of any particular group has a legal right to membership on an advisory board. Now, this could be interpreted as being that the representatives of the listener sponsors wouldn't have a legal right to sit on a local advisory board. Now, my concern is specifically with reference to CPB funding. It looks as though you'll have to cease taking this money. Are there any plans in place right now to end this practice?
Slasher, I think it's a fantastic question. I'm going to move you through something very quickly because we have about a minute left before we have to end the show.
Right.
On Thursday, this Thursday at 3 p.m., we're going to have a show that discusses this exact subject and many more about local governance.
Great.
If I could trouble you to try to call us back then.
I'll be on a plane heading to L.A., so I'm going to be there at the national board meeting.
Excellent.
Right, I believe it's on the agenda on the national board meeting to talk about the local advisory boards and how they were going to be set up and how the elections would happen.
That's right. There's going to be bylaws committees.
That's right. And without being too quick with you, Slasher, I'm going to ask that you show up at that board meeting and express those feelings.
I'll be there.
Great. And if I may take this opportunity with less than a minute to let everybody know that we will be having on Monday. Yeah, you're very welcome. Mondays in March, every Monday we will be covering opportunities to cover issues that are very close to our heart and of concern here. I've been joined today by Brian DeSager and by Matthew Lazar. Brian's from our wonderful archives, and Matthew has written a wonderful history called Pacifica Radio, The Rise of Alternative Network, true historians, both. And if I may thank both of them and encourage the listeners to stay tuned for our next Monday in March, next Monday. Thank you very much for joining us here at KPFK-FM 90.7 Los Angeles.
Thanks.
Thank you.